And with that, let's get into our discussion with today's candidates. Cornell Razor, you actually, as it turns out, this is the seat that was formerly held by Sage Dixon, and you were just appointed to that seat. So you're an incumbent for 6-8 weeks, I guess.
Yeah, kind of.
And why don't we start with you and take a couple minutes for an opening statement. Tell us a little bit about yourself. And also, if you would address the question, why are you running?
So thank you, Chris. Thank you for doing this. I appreciate it. I think it's a great service to the community. I grew up around here. I went to school here and went to the University of Idaho. Actually went to North Idaho College and University of Idaho. I was going to be a veterinarian. That didn't turn out. But I've logged and I've worked in the mills. And recently I just lost the job at the Army Surplus, but I'm working on getting that job back. So,
yeah, and unfortunately for folks, it may not, the building burned down.
Oh, yeah. July. Well, yeah. Okay. Yeah, there is, I guess I didn't give any context. But I was a county commissioner for 4 years, served in that capacity. That was a great opportunity to serve the constituents here in Bonner County. I learned a lot about state and county government. I learned a lot about how the state often imposes things on local counties that are very difficult to deal with. So I think one of the things I might be able to bring to the state legislature is a perspective on state law and how it impacts counties, especially property taxes and things like that. So I have, I've been married 48 years. Actually in October, I'll be married 48 years to a girl I went to high school with. And I have three kids and 16 grandkids. And I guess you asked why I'm running. I'm running because I want to see the state of Idaho continue to be a bastion for freedom and an encouraging place for people to live and to be able to raise families without fear of much government interference and continue the state's legacy of freedom and education for all and just continue in that aspect as a legislator that will continue to work for that. So,
okay. Well, thank you, Cornell Razor. Catherine Larson, the Democratic candidate, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
Okay, so my career has been spent working with mom-and-pop organizations, nonprofits, and some of the biggest companies in the world. I've led successful programs with companies that are bigger, have more employees than we have people in Bonner and Boundary County. I worked side by side to craft solutions that work for the front line and work for the C-suite. I know that I can go to Boise and represent us, the people of Boundary and Bonner County, and listen and advocate and negotiate solutions that that don't get us into a million lawsuits. I worked with the military, and we deployed a strategy called Center of Gravity. And that's where you look at complex situations and identify with all the competing priorities and difficult situations and risks and look at what is the single biggest thing that we could do to move forward to move us towards our goals. So when I look at Bonner and Boundary County, our goals are to have a place where our kids can come and raise their families, where they can have jobs, they can afford houses, a place where we have educational opportunities and work opportunities, a place where we have health care for everyone, and we can actually get a doctor's appointment when we need a doctor's appointment. And so we've got a lot of priorities here. The list goes on. If I look at what's happened with the state, they have consistently over the last 20 years, they've reduced the tax dollars that they spend towards our local and our local governments, and that evens out the cost and benefits. Their job is to even out the cost and benefits across urban and rural areas. And over the past 20 years, they haven't done that. And our elected officials have been happy that that's happened. They've been have pride in that. And they've increased our control. So that's why I'm running.
Okay. Well, I'm going to actually alternate between the two of you about who goes first on questions. And my first question just rolls right into what you were starting there, Catherine. Can you go ahead and tell us the issues, maybe the top three or four issues that are animating your campaign, the reason you're running?
Okay, so just to finish that piece on the critical, on the center of gravity, that, you know, our local rural costs have more than quadrupled, and the people, fewer people are shouldering the burden. So we pay more and we get less than people in Ada County, which I think is taxation without representation. And it's not that the state doesn't have the money. We had a $1 billion surplus, but instead of funding our schools and our roads, they gave it back primarily to the wealthy. And so I think that we need to pass levies for basic services, and I think this is our center of gravity. Boiling out from that, I think it's housing costs, I think it's education, I think it's healthcare, and our economy, you know, just boosting the economy that works here, and minimizing our freedoms, because that's the other thing, is in conjunction with squeezing the funding for local governments, they've increased the control over local governments.
Okay. Thank you for that, Catherine. Cornell Razor, same question to you. You get up to a couple of minutes here to tell about the issues you think are most important.
Well, the issues that are most important, I would have to allege, are the ones that my constituents have been emailing to me since they all thought I have already attained the seat. Some of them relate to illegal aliens, especially the ones that are we find in the state of Idaho, election integrity. People are concerned that it's a little bit too easy for those who are not citizens of Idaho to vote. So there is a constitutional amendment that will put into the state constitution that only U.S. citizens can vote in the state of Idaho. Right now it just says citizens, and while there are statutes that address that, I think it's important to put it in the Constitution. I don't like amending the Constitution very much, but in this particular case, it's much more difficult to change the Constitution than it is to change statute, so it would be a little bit more firm. One of the other issues that people have been emailing me about is the cost of education and some ways to address that. I believe there are ways that we can address that using some of the endowment and state lands that are underperforming right now. There are states that have successfully utilized their state funds to offset the cost of education without increasing property taxes. I would love to see something like that. Another issue is, strangely enough, one of the ones that's been sent to me was the concern about banking issues in Idaho, Idaho's banking laws, which could be more protective of citizens so that when they have a lifestyle or a way of earning money that includes firearms or things like that, they can't automatically be shut off from being able to utilize the credit systems in this country. And Idaho's banking laws could be strengthened to that effect. So those are some of the things. Another one is the borders, but I did mention illegal aliens, so those kind of go hand in hand. Idaho has had our governor has actually sent assisting troops to the Texas border. I think we can do more than that here in Idaho with some of our other legislation, but we can talk more about that at length later on.
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, let's get into some of the questions that I put together here. And to start with, the legislature is typically in session just January through March or April. but you're going to serve a 2-year term. So, how do you feel the legislature's performed the last two sessions? Do you think it's been productive or not, or would you like to see improvements? You start first on that.
So I think it was fairly productive. One of the things that I would like to see is an addressing of some of the improper laws that have been passed over the last century that Idaho's been around. I believe it was Calvin Coolidge said that it's just as important to remove bad law as it is to enact good law. So I'm going to be looking into some of that. But as far as the legislature's performance, it was even-handed, and there was some good things done, some things left undone, which will have to be addressed, including property tax burden, things like that. But all in all, it was a pretty productive session.
Mm-hmm. Catherine Larson, same question to you. How do you think the legislature's been doing?
So I feel like the legislation has spent its time on things that aren't as important issues to us as they could be. For example, you talked about the constitutional amendment that they're trying to get through right now. That's law to enforce law. You know, we've already got the laws in place. Why are we going through this effort? And there's been a lot of fear-mongering to get people up in arms about things that aren't really issues here. And I think that distracts us from doing things that could really help Boundary and Bonner County. Which of our neighbors would you want to deport from the country? I mean, immigration, is that one of the core issues here for us in Boundary and Bonner County? I've seen some overreach in the control of the state on what we can do here. Again, trying to tie our hands and spending time on issues that aren't really issues. Okay. And the JFAC changes where they now have line item control down to the nth degree, I believe is total state overreach.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, speaking of issues, we'll get into a few of those now from my questions I put together for you. And you both actually have kind of referred to this a little bit. Catherine, you go first on this one. The Idaho's tax system includes income tax, sales tax, and property taxes. Do you think it's properly balanced? And I think the part that comes under most scrutiny is the property tax, because that burden on homeowners has been drawing criticisms as our home values have gone up a lot for people that live here. Their incomes don't necessarily go up, but those property taxes do go up because of that. Would you seek any changes in Idaho's tax system?
Yes. As I mentioned before, you know, I believe that the state has shrunk its duty. So instead of paying 75% of public services for us, now it's only paying 50%, which puts a huge burden on rural areas like ours. That means our property taxes are way, way, way higher than they ought to be. I think there's a couple of ways to do that. One is quit giving back tax refunds at the state level and then just shifting the burden right onto the shoulders of local taxpayers. That's one of the reasons our property taxes are so high. I think there's some other things we can do about residents here, the taxes for if you live in your home here versus if it's a vacation home or a vacation rental. I think the state has also been reaching down and trying to control what cities and counties can do, what kinds of rules they can make. I think we need to stop the endless levies for schools. We shouldn't be having to have a levy to have normal operating costs. That should be covered by the state.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Same question to you, Cornell. The tax system, would you seek changes there? I mean, with probably a particular question as concerns property taxes.
So, yeah, the property tax is becoming much more of a burden to people, especially a great demographic that's moving here is the older folks that are retiring. And even from states where they had quite a bit of money, at some point you find out that your fixed income won't cover everything. I went grocery shopping the other day, and the sticker shock was incredible. It's been a while since I've spent a lot of time grocery shopping myself. My wife usually does most of that because she's a lot smarter than me at that. But one of the things that could be done is better management of our state lands in a manner that allows grazing and mining fees to be used towards defraying property taxes like that's done in other states, some other states. And I'm talking about appropriate use of the lands, not raping or strip mining or clear cutting, because that's the fear mongering that will be used to prevent us from actually managing our lands in a manner that will yield a better return. The states already better manage their lands than the federal government does. For every $16 the federal government invests, they lose 37. For every $2.16 the states invest in their lands, they make $20+. So the opportunities for the states to better manage the lands, and Utah's leading the way in this. I believe that they've got a template we can use for ourselves. I've actually brought some of it with me this morning. If the issue comes up, we can talk about it at more length. But property taxes are a great burden. And when I was a county commissioner, occasionally the state would pass laws that contained with them unfunded mandates on the counties. And the only way the counties could pay for those often was in raising property taxes. And that was a great frustration. I'd like to make sure that the state does not continue to do those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you for that. And actually, I'm going to circle right back on a on an issue that you brought up. It's on my list, and it has to do with public lands. There are some folks that are moving. We'd like to see some of our public lands transferred to private ownership. Where do you stand on that? And you already mentioned you could elaborate any more about management of the public lands we do have, and then we'll come to Catherine with the same question.
Yeah, I would be more concerned at this time of the state of Idaho taking over management of them and managing them as public, multiple-use public lands. There are grazing and mining fees, as I mentioned earlier, that could be exacted, much in the same way that it's done on some of the endowment lands. Other states are doing this. The state of Utah pointed out that Utah sends roughly $225 million in royalty payments on BLM-controlled land to the federal government every year, and those royalty payments could be used to help Utah actually manage the lands. The same thing could happen in Idaho. We have a tract of land in Idaho approximately the size of the state of Arkansas that is federally managed, and wasn't a slip of the tongue, Chris. Okay. And for that reason, I believe that there's great opportunity for some of that land, not all of it, but for some of it, to be managed in a manner that would bring more money into the state coffers and be able to use to offset school bond levies. I agree with Catherine. It's very frustrating for these school districts to have to come up with these bond levies only to incur the wrath of the voters in their districts. And in some cases, there really are needs for those school districts. In some cases, it's a result of needs coupled with poor management of their funds in the first place. But those are things that can be addressed, continue to be addressed by school district boards as they move forward in dealing with their issues at local level. Mm-hmm. But if we could manage to offset some of that with money from the state that wouldn't come from the pockets of other taxpayers, I think that would be a win-win.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Catherine Larson, same question to you. Do you support public lands? We'd like to see them transferred to private ownership. And do you identify issues with the management of our public lands?
So I support public lands. I feel like that, you know, this whole idea that we're going to take back our federal lands into the state ownership, you know, the data says that would increase the cost to us, to our state budget, of as much as 30%, because managing for fire alone is just a huge burden. So it's a little bit unrealistic to think that we could take back these federal lands and make a whole bunch of money and not spend a whole bunch of money. It also would require a constitutional amendment. So it would be something that we would basically have to take a student body left and focus all our energies on trying to get this done. And then once we got them, we couldn't afford them, so we would end up selling them off, and we would end up like Ohio, that basically doesn't have any access to public lands at all anymore because people put fences up. And what we're seeing is that people are putting fences up that's restricting access to existing public land because they can. And so I believe that and I've also seen when we do take them back into the state hands, oftentimes we end up just selling them off, like what we're doing up at Priest Lake right now. And so I feel like that is a bit of a, you know, I do believe that it's a complex issue. We've got to figure out how do we use public lands in a way that brings in multi-use and also allows people to use them recreationally. You know, there are ways that we can do that, but it's a complex issue, and some of these vast sweeping things where we're going to go change the Constitution and take back our public lands, I think that we would catch the car and not know what to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you for that. By the way, I do want to mention that if you guys do want to have a follow-up or a rebuttal to your opponent's statement, just let me know. And
may I?
Yeah, you bet. Take just a minute, and then Catherine, you'll have another opportunity. Yeah.
So the fear-mongering, and with all due respect, the fear-mongering that is used in this is, well, if we take them all back at once and don't have any money to manage them, we'll go bankrupt, or some variation of that. You don't take them all back at the same time. You begin incorporating them into the state inventory at in groups and in sections. We tried to do this when I was a county commissioner with the Good Neighbor, I believe it was called the Good Neighbor Plan or something
policy
like that.
Or something.
Policy, yeah. Raul Labrador, we were working on just allowing the federal government to have the state control and manage 200,000 acres. The federal government got to pick where they were and everything, and they just wouldn't do it. And my contention is they wouldn't do it because they knew we'd manage it better, and it would become very clear. This was 15 years ago. The public lands of Priest Lake, remember, they're not multi-use lands. Those are houses. Those are what would you call them? Recreation.
The lands that were recently sold. They were cabin leases.
Cabin leases. Yeah. They weren't multi-use lands, so that's not a good example. The acquisition of these lands would be done in a careful fashion, and it would not be with the express purpose of selling them off. It would be for the express purpose of managing them in such a manner as to bring money into the state coffers to alleviate some of the other issues we talked about. So I just want to make sure we understood that this is, we're not talking about selling them all to George Soros or some other billionaire. We're talking about managing them at the state level, like states have been doing. And the fact is, it's actually following the law, which we really should be doing, because the Constitution never authorized the states to have these kinds of things. Our Constitution doesn't even. In Article 19, the disclaimer in Article 19 of our Constitution says that Idaho disclaims the use and taxation of all these lands until such time as the federal government extinguishes title. Mm-hmm. And that was clearly understood in the 1890s when our Constitution was written, when the Enabling Acts of the Dakotas and Washington was written. Every state has that in their Constitution. And if you look east of Colorado, you'll see they average about 6% federal, and west, it's far more. Not Nevada's 81%, Idaho's 62%, New Mexico's 23%. It's far in advance, and the federal government was never intended to own all those lands. They're clearly outlined in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution.
Okay. Catherine, you got a couple more minutes on this subject.
I won't take so long. Okay. The Good Neighbor program, I'm glad you brought that up. That is actually a program that I would support us doubling down on, making that work, because that is something that I think is a plan that has promise, and we made progress on it, and so that's a good approach. But I do think that even though you don't plan to sell the land to George Soros, we have people from Texas who are coming up right now and buying whatever they can buy and fencing it off. And so I think it is naive to think that we will take this back and everybody will act in a good way. We won't clear cut it. I've been doing trail work on some of the lands here that have been clear cut for school programs. So we have programs like KVRI up in Boundary County, where we've got the tribes, the city, the county, all working together to try to figure out how to use them in the best way. And so I think that we have vehicles now, and to spend all of our time trying to change Constitution and go back to rules from the beginning of our statehood is, I mean, it's a choice if that's where we want to spend our time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Well, let's turn to another issue, which you both already touched on a little bit, but I have a couple more specific questions, and that's education. Idaho for many years has been in the actually the very bottom among the 50 states in funding education at the state level. Last session, the legislature approved and Governor Brad Little signed House Bill 521, under which Idaho will spend an additional $1.5 billion over the next decade to help fund building construction and maintenance for our schools. Two questions here. I start, I think, with you on this one, Cornell. Would you have supported or opposed this bill that set aside all this money for the schools? And then also, can you follow up on that? What's your posture on vouchers, which would provide funds for parents to choose private schools, but which critics say would reduce the funds available for public schools?
So to my shame, I don't have a good working knowledge of House Bill 521, but I can give a couple caveats. If it was financially responsible and the money that's put into education will actually go to the local districts, then I would have probably voted for it. Regarding vouchers, I'm not a big fan of vouchers. I lean a little bit more in the direction of education savings accounts. What I would like to see is the opportunity for parents to direct the funds that they want to spend on their children. And yes, if it pulls money out of the public schools, well, but it also pulls students out. So it pulls the people that the money was being spent on. So if they're actually managing their budgets properly, the reduction in cost would also go along with the reduction in income. So If I stop buying certain things and stop making money on them in my business, I spend the money on something else. That's not a perfect analogy, but the idea is reduction of costs and reduction of spendings have no problem if they go hand in hand. So there are a couple of states that have pursued this. I believe the state of Oklahoma has legislation, has actually passed education savings accounts. I would be in favor of those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Catherine, same question to you. Would you have support or opposed the funding bill that was passed in the last legislature? And what's your posture on vouchers?
So I would have supported that bill, but I don't think that it does enough. And I think that the algorithms that they're using and how they allocate the funds to rural areas like ours, and they don't actually classify West Bonner County School and Boundary County as rural because of Sandpoint. So the algorithms are such that we are not getting enough money to support our schools, and it's disproportionately going to urban areas. It's also not enough. And at the same time that they gave this $1.5 billion for schools, they gave back money in tax breaks, primarily again to the wealthy, that are projected to reduce the general fund by $1.5 billion. So I think it's not enough, and it's not done in the proper way to fund our schools. As far as the Supreme Court has said that the state has a responsibility to fund the schools, and they're not. And that's one of the things. Legislators have a great deal of control over whether they release funding or don't. That's one of their biggest strengths. On vouchers, I'm opposed to vouchers because it's not the right equation to say we'll pull the kids out and then the schools, you know, the money goes to where the schools are. Because what we've seen is we're paying $6,500 per student up in Boundary and Bonner County. It's the lowest in the state. An average across the state is $8,000, but here in our county, it's $6,500 per student. Yet, we have performance in our schools at right in the middle for the country. So our schools are performing above average, just barely, but above average across the country, even though we're starving them. If we turn our education system into a for-profit system, which is what vouchers do, businesses can't afford to function at a high quality at that low level rate. So in Arizona, what we're seeing, which is the poster child for voucher systems, that in 2 years, they've experienced a $1.5 billion deficit in their general fund because of vouchers. They can't pay for critical water systems. So if we turn our education system into a for-profit business, it will destroy our public education, and then we will have no choice but to send our kids to lower quality for-profit schools.
Okay, well, thank you both for addressing that one. And this next question goes first to you, Catherine. But first, I should mention that this is the 88.5 KRFY Morning Show, and today we are talking with the Idaho Legislature House Seat B candidates, Catherine Larson, Democrat, and Republican Cornell Razor. So my next question is has to do with health care, and Catherine, to you first on this one. The institution of the abortion ban in Idaho, with few exceptions for a pregnant patient's health, has been cited as one of the reasons Bonner General Health discontinued our obstetrical care here, which has created some real problems for young families that are having kids. Doctors statewide say they fear they could face criminal charges. And in fact, there was recently a very big example of that, because Dr. Amelia Huntsberger, she was an OBGYN doctor here in Sandpoint, just a couple of weeks testified before a U.S. Senate committee and said she left the state because it no longer felt safe to practice medicine. It's led other doctors to leave. And so my question to the candidates, Catherine, you first, do you see need to address this? And if so, how would you address it?
So I absolutely see a need to address this. You know, it's really not about abortions. This law has not reduced abortions at all in the state. But what it has done is chased away our doctors. I met a pro-life doctor who moved here to be an OBGYN here because he read about what was going on in our state. And then he looked at the laws and said, I cannot risk my medical license and a fine and prison sentence to practice medicine here. So I think that we have to get politicians out of our doctor's offices. We have politicians who think you can swallow a camera to see if a woman is pregnant. And I don't want those politicians distracting my doctor from my medical care. If you look at the number of abortions in the country, it's misleading because many, many, many of those are what's called DNC. It's a procedure that helps a woman whose the fetus has died or cannot survive. And those procedures allow the woman not to have the baby decompose inside their body and make them deathly ill. And so to have a law that says we cannot treat women who are in desperate need of health care because the politicians are saying, doctors, if that baby dies, you may go to prison, is it's just insane. I support legislation that we can put in place that will, in fact, reduce abortions. We have data from other states on what they've done to reduce the number of abortions that women are seeking. And I would support things like that. But having politicians in our doctor's offices is absolutely unsafe and dangerous for all people who live here. Whether you are pro-life or you are pro-choice, this is bad legislation.
Cornell Razor, same question to you. Do you want me to repeat that one?
You don't need to.
Okay.
So I'm going to avoid the fear-mongering. I'm actually going to read the law. The following shall not be considered criminal abortions for the purposes of subsection 1 of this section. The physician determined in his good faith medical judgment and based on the facts known to the physician at the time that the abortion was necessary to prevent the death of the pregnant woman. Currently, Idaho law does not preclude abortions to prevent death, whether they be a baby in the womb that has begun to decompose or a fallopian tube pregnancy. So those are all covered. The fact is that Kootenai County and Bonner County have been keeping records required by the state of Idaho to report abortions. And in the past 20 years, neither of them have reported any. And the people that I've talked to say that actually this is the same kind of problem that people are having nationwide. They can't get good workers. One nurse, and there's so much politicization going on that they're afraid to come forward and speak when they have someone go to a U.S. Senate hearing and propagate what appears to be political pandering. The fact is, what they're struggling with is doctors that do not have enough help, so they're working extremely long hours, and they're not sticking around because it gets old. Doctors are used to working long hours, but in talking to some of the people that are the support staff at Bonner General, that's not what's really going on. The law protects them, so there's no reason for them to not have an obstetric practice in Idaho. The law protects them from being able to protect a woman from dying because of a pregnancy gone awry. And the fact is, the situation is they can't get good help, is what some of the people that we've talked to have said.
Okay.
So that's much simpler.
Okay.
And less political. The problem is if they come out and say that, they'll be vilified.
Mm-hmm. The problem is that word death, because it's not just about a woman dying. So my doctor is looking at my granddaughter and saying, well, is she going to die or is she just going to be sick forever? For every woman that dies in childbirth, 100 women experience lifelong health issues. And so that's been the real issue, is that doctors have to determine, are they really going to die? Are they not going to die? If they're not going to die, and then I get into a court situation. We lost 4 OBGYNs simultaneously in our county, in our small little county. 22% of OBGYNs have fled the state. We're now losing pediatricians because the burden is coming further on them. I'm talking to women in Boundary County who have to drive 2 hours to have their babies. And I agree with you that the medical the healthcare system needs our attention. It needs our attention to figure out how to have a system that doesn't overburden our doctors. That's where we should be focusing. We shouldn't be focusing on trying to criminalize, again, like you said, no abortions in 20 years. So why are we doubling down and criminalizing it and making doctors have to consider, is this the health of the mother or the life of the mother? I think we need to focus our efforts on real problems here locally.
Two quick things, Chris.
You get another minute and a half.
So I won't need that much time. A simple internet search shows that there are thriving OBGYN clinics in other hospitals in the state. I did it just the other day. And secondly, this is not a doctor determining whether or not the spleen is going to kill the person. He's making a decision about killing a living human being. And that's far more weighty on a doctor's conscience. And I'm glad they take the time, but they should only take the time necessary once they've determined it's right and it's appropriate and it's needed to save the mother's life. Then they're authorized by Idaho law to do that.
Okay. Thank you both for addressing that. It's a pretty difficult subject, no matter how it slices out, I'll tell you.
No pun intended, huh?
Yeah. No. Yeah, well, sorry. That bad word choice on my part, I guess. Let's turn to a whole different subject here. Proposition 1, the Open Primaries Initiative, it's going to be on the ballot in November. If it's approved, it would end Idaho's closed Republican primary so that all voters, regardless of party affiliation, could vote in the primary election. It would also allow voters to rank candidates in their order of preference. Starting first, I think, with you on this one, Cornell, do you favor or support Proposition 1?
Do I favor or support? Give me the other option, Chris.
Okay.
Go ahead. You told me there were no gotchas.
I'm just testing you.
I do not support it. There's so much misinformation about this. One of the supporters says it'll take Idaho back to the primaries we used to have. That's completely false. We used to have the honor system. And when you went, I grew up here, remember? I've been voting since just after Nixon. You would go in and you would choose your ballot, Republican, Democrat, Constitution, whatever, and then you would take it to your booth and you would vote in the primary. Well, it became evident that the Democrat Party did not have any good conservative ideas, so they began choosing the Republican ballots, and they would vote for the less conservative Republic on the ballot, so the Republican Party closed the primary in 2012. If we go back to that, that's completely different than what they're taking us to, which is essentially a jungle primary. Alaska's trying to get rid of it. They dislike it. In California, a botched election candidate was declared the winner, but two months later, also, you can't do a hand recount in a ranked choice voting. It has to be done by the very computers that ratcheted the votes in the first place. But 2 months later, a recount revealed that there was an issue with the algorithm, resulting in an error, the error being Resnick's victory. Mike Hutchinson, who had finished third, was now the winner. Confusion. What happened in Maine 2018? 8,000 votes weren't counted. Alaska 2022, 15,000 votes eliminated. Arlington County, Virginia dumped it after one election, and it's a liberal county because of the difficulties. It's so confusing. In one election in Alaska in 2022, there were 40 people on the ballot. Now, I don't think I would have time to research that many, and I'm a research junkie. So the current system we have is, especially in Idaho, is easily audited, especially in some of the smaller counties. It's hand-counted. It's counted at the precinct level and at the local county level, and it's some of the most secure elections in Idaho. This would be putting our elections in the hands of some of the people that have been implicated implicated in fraud in certain states in the country, in Georgia and in Wisconsin. And so I don't think we need it. I think what we've got isn't broken, and we're trying to break it real bad.
Okay, same question to you, Catherine Larson. Do you support or oppose the Proposition 1 Open Primaries Initiative?
So I fully support Proposition 1. And the biggest reason is that we've got 250,000 veterans in the state of Idaho who are disenfranchised right now. They are independent voters, and they don't have a say because the election is over in the primary. We've got a small percentage of the people who are making the decision for the rest of the state. And what you've seen now is that a lot of people are re-registering as Republicans in order to have their vote heard. What this proposition does is it breaks the power of parties, both parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. They won't be able to manipulate the vote. It really goes back to the hands of the people. There's a lot of fear-mongering. There's a ton of money that's been poured into the state, primarily to make sure that the party maintains control over this. A couple of pieces. First of all, Alaska does have it on the ballot. That doesn't mean the Alaska people don't want it. That means that it's up for a vote. So to say that is a bit disingenuous. We've played this game. We actually created a simulated version of Proposition 1, both the primary vote and the ranked choice voting, and people can figure it out. And you can hand count it. If you really want to hand count it, you can hand count it. Ireland does it. But we've got technology that works. You alluded to the fact that this would put control back to the people who have you alluded to the fact that elections weren't fair. There have been many, many, many lawsuits looking at and analyzing and going back to voting systems, and our elections are extremely fair, and they always have been, and in the U.S. And I've experienced it in that I went in and voted, and my vote got put into the wrong basket where it wasn't counted. And I was able to call up, and they found out exactly what happened and what was done in that election. And so I think we've got a lot of smoke screens, and I support Prop 1.
Okay. Well, you guys have both alluded to my next question.
I give a real quick?
Okay, you bet. Yeah.
So the 250,000 supposedly disenfranchised voters can be adults and make choices like the rest of us do, like we always do in every election, and choose a ballot to vote. And we've been doing it that way for the longest time. And Catherine pointed out that her missed vote was easily retrievable and fixed in the current system we have. It's not broken. Let's keep it.
Well,
okay, you get 30 seconds into yourself, Catherine. Yeah.
Yeah, so what you're hoping is that what you're saying is everybody can be adults and register as Republicans. We'll all be the sneeches on the beaches with the stars on our bellies. What I also look at is the Republican platform that now says if we all do that, then there will never, ever be any other party that has any voice in how our state is redistricted. And so that is not the America I want to live in. We are mostly independents here, and wouldn't it be nice if none of us had to align ourselves with a party?
Okay. We hashed that one out. Okay, we are going to be running out of time here shortly. I'm going to ask one more question, and then we'll go to give you guys a little bit of time to make some closing statements. And you guys have both actually alluded to this, and it really kind of comes off the last question. Election integrity is a concern for some voters. And I think this one goes first to Catherine, I guess. Do you feel Idaho's elections are fairly and accurately conducted? Idaho Secretary of State Phil McGrain said recently that there have been no known attempts by foreign groups to interfere in our elections.
Yes, I think our election system has a lot of integrity. We are able to track who's voted. We've got good quality systems. What's happened over the course of the last 8 years as the integrity of our election system has been attacked unfairly, there's been no evidence of any election integrity problems. What it's done is it's caused states to start to say, we're going to pull out and we're not going to be part of the ability to actually track it and follow it. So I think that we are in danger of reducing election integrity by knee-jerk reactions because we don't trust it.
Cornell, same question to you.
I would consider Proposition 1 a knee-jerk reaction, and I agree completely. We need to not fix something that isn't broken. Our election integrity is intact. It's conducted at the local level, and it's conducted fairly. It's conducted with integrity. And why would we give that away?
I don't think we have to give it away to get Proposition 1. It's not an either or.
Okay. Well, thank you both for an excellent conversation here today. And we're going to give you guys a minute to 2 minutes each to make your final pitch to voters, at least in this form. And Catherine, why don't we start with you with a closing statement?
I just want to say that we live in an amazing place. We have amazing businesses that are here. We have, you know, we have the number one refrigerated salad dressing in the world. We have helicopter companies, airplane companies. We've got great retail stores. We have ingenuity. You know, there was a man who started building the floats for float planes, and that led to our whole aviation industry here. What I see the state doing is rather than supporting and invigorating and clearing obstacles for those businesses, and instead of investing in education to create a really good, rich employee base for that, I would love to see us support what we're doing here already with the amazing people. We've got 500 nonprofits that are filling the gap right now. What if they were actually putting the icing on the cake instead of having to be the cake? So I just would really love to see our state government focus on invigorating the businesses here, the middle class here, the working families here, instead of creating more controls and reducing the funds.
Well, Catherine Larson, House Seat B candidate, how can people learn more about your candidacy?
So I have a website, CatherineLarsonForIdaho.com. I'm also on Instagram and Facebook, and I'm going to try to be on Twitter. It's on my website. You can see it there.
Okay. Thank you. Cornell Razor, go ahead and give us your closing statement.
Startlingly, I find myself in agreement with Catherine. I think we should do just what Governor Little has been doing, reducing regulations, and what the legislature has been attempting to do with the new JFAC regulations, which reduces taxation. This will cause business to flourish, which will put more money in the hands of the people, which is where it belongs. It could have the extra benefit, overflowing effect of benefiting education. And I think one of the things that I'm going to try to draw attention to is put a little bit more emphasis on the trades. We need people in the trades, and they can actually get involved in local community colleges and learn a good trade and be making money within just a few years without the gigantic college debt that comes nowadays. Really quickly, I remember when I went to the University of Idaho, my tuition for one semester was $201. Those days have changed.
Okay. Well, Cornell Razor, do you want to tell us how can people learn more about you?
So I have a website, CornellForIdaho.com. It's Cornell, CornellForIdaho.com. I'm on Facebook and I'm on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I want to say thank you again to our two candidates for House Seat B here in Idaho Legislative District 1, the Democrat Catherine Larson, the Republican Cornell Razor. And this will be posted on our website, KFY.org. There'll be a recording there later today that people can tune into if they didn't catch the whole thing. And I want to say as well, there is a forum tonight, and you guys can carry on your discussion there with all the other candidates. It's at the Sandpoint High School Auditorium. Starts at 5:30 tonight. So I will probably see you there.
Thanks, Chris.
And I really appreciate you both coming in.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you, Catherine.
Yeah, thank you, Cornell.